Radio Times. Our discussion in this hour of Radio Times may not be appropriate for children. A new study by researchers at Indiana University's Center for Sexual Health and Promotion offers a revealing glimpse into the private lives of Americans, from teenagers to those in their mid-90s. The study found that behavior has changed since the last national study 16 years ago, showing that many people engage in a wide variety of sexual activities. They also found a so-called orgasm gap and that teenagers are not as sexually reckless as we've been led to believe. The study was published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine and was funded by Church and Dwight. They happen to be the makers of Trojan brand condoms. And joining us in this hour to talk about this new study are two of the authors, Debbie Herbenick and Stephanie Sanders. Debbie Herbenick is research scientist and associate director of Indiana University's Center for Sexual Health Promotion, co-author of the study, as I said, and author of a book called Because It Feels Good, A Women's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Debbie Herbenick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Stephanie Sanders is Associate Director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, where she's also a professor in the Department of Gender Studies. And Stephanie Sanders, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure.
Debbie Herbenick, if I can begin with you, why is it important to have a national study such as this?
It's been about almost 20 years, actually, since our last nationally representative study of sexual behavior in the United States. And, of course, sex affects people's lives in many different ways. Some of this has to do with health and what we do and how it puts us at risk for different things like pregnancy or infection. And other things have to do with just our relationships and people wanting to know what their neighbors do and people wanting to talk to their partners about, what they're interested in. But many of that goes back to, what do people where I live do? What do people my age do? People who are married or single or partnered like me. So we really just needed a contemporary look at sexual behavior in the United States, and we're fortunate to have this opportunity to do such an expansive study ranging in age from 14 to 94.
And to you, Stephanie Sanders, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but are people honest when they talk about their sexual behavior?
Well, when we study sexual behavior, we always have to rely, or almost always when this kind of study, we certainly rely on self-report. And what we try to do is develop techniques that make it easy for people to tell the truth about those behaviors, and then to have questions that help us kind of cross-check the validity of that. Of course, there may be people who don't answer truthfully, but that's going to be a problem across all studies that are asking about personal behavior.
And these were questions that were asked not face-to-face, but through the Internet. Do I have that right, Stephanie Sanders?
Yes, and actually there is research that shows that people are more willing to divulge sensitive information to computers than they are to human interviewers.
And just to add, as I said in the introduction, this was funded by the makers of Trojan brand condoms. Can we take this, Stephanie Sanders, as objective research?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's been delightful about working with the people from Church and Dwight, the Trojan team, is that they really allowed us to take the lead on the design of the study and the questions. They really did not try to interfere with what we were trying to do. They basically gave us feedback like other colleagues would, about questions and things like that. It was really quite, we feel that we were really given leeway to do this study the way we wanted to do it as researchers.
And we wanted to make sure our listeners, in full disclosure, knew where the funding was coming from.
Yes.
And Debbie Herbenick, let me go back to you. As you mentioned, the last national survey was done almost 20 years ago. Would it be fair to say that things are changing in the bedroom?
Things are changing in the bedroom in some ways. In other ways, we're all still interested in each other and in ourselves and engaging in a range of private and shared sexual behaviors. But yeah, there have been some significant changes.
Such as?
There's been one of the most notable ones in terms of behavior is that a far greater proportion of women and men report having engaged in anal intercourse these days compared to the study from almost 20 years ago. Now, some of that may be an artifact of how we ask questions. So, like Dr. Sander was saying, we do know from research that sometimes people are more apt to share sensitive information when they're responding to a computer rather than a person, and the study 20 years ago did involve face-to-face interviews. But it is a different world now, too, and we have the internet now, and we didn't 20 years ago, and people have easier access to sexually explicit images, and we certainly know that almost twice as many, actually, people have tried anal intercourse now compared to then. It doesn't mean that it's a frequent behavior. It's not. But there are more people who have engaged in it at least once in their lives.
And does that cover a wide range of people or a subset?
It's not. Sometimes people have thought that this was an emerging behavior just among the young, but in fact the higher rates are people in their 30s, 40s, and even 50s. So it does cover a wide range of ages, and there are people on both ends of the spectrum as well in terms of younger and older. There are other things, too, that we don't know necessarily if they've changed because they just weren't asked about the last time, but one of the more striking findings from our perspective even had to do with the proportion of women that were experiencing pain during the most recent time that they had sex. And it was almost one-third of women that experienced some difficulty with pain compared to about 5% of men.
And I do want to get to that. But to you, Stephanie Sanders and Debbie Herbenick mentioned the internet. And as we all know, the internet is there's an entire world there. And a lot of that world has to do with sex and sexual behavior. Do you think that has influenced what it is that people do these days?
It's a very good question. It certainly means that there's information out there, various kinds, that hasn't been before. It also means that there are new forms of communication with others, and but that's not the only change in the last 20 years, but it's certainly a significant one. Although this study was not really designed to look at sexuality focused in terms of how the internet impacts it.
But nonetheless, the findings are interesting.
Oh, yes.
Indeed. I mean, I wonder whether you think even the influence of same-sex marriage or the fact that many more gays and lesbians are out, do you think that has impacted people's behavior, Stephanie Sanders?
Well, I think there are a number of things that we should point out about this, and that is that in this gap that we've had since the last large national survey, we've had the proliferation of the internet, social networking, a vast proliferation of all kinds of media into the home. We also have had the advent of Viagra and the erection-enhancing drugs. We've had the situation of more discussion about gay marriage. And so there have been a lot of things that have changed socially that could be impacting our lives. Certainly, prior to drugs like Viagra, you didn't see erection discussed. Now we have ED, and it's, being advertised on television, that you can get drugs to deal with this. So the conversation about sexuality has changed in this time period.
And Debbie Herbenick, is there any way to know whether people are enjoying their sex lives anymore these days than they were, let's say, a generation or two ago?
We don't have great comparable data in terms of 20 years ago, but we ask different questions. But we certainly do know that the vast majority of men and women who were reporting a recent sex event did say that it was pleasurable or arousing. So for the most part, sex is still good for people.
Picking up on what you said earlier, though, that you said a third of women said they experience pain in sex. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so we found that about 30% of women across the age groups experienced some degree of pain the last time that they had sex, as compared to about 5% of men. And this was a pretty striking finding. We already knew going into it that more women would report pain during sex than men. But 30% is pretty big. Now, even if some of this pain is mild or fleeting, it still speaks to the fact that women and men probably experience their sexual lives in very different ways, and this is one of them. And it's something that we may not talk openly about, that we're not sure how well couples communicate about. We didn't assess what happens after they experience the pain, if they talk about it with their partner or not. But it is something I think we should pay better attention to.
And to you, Stephanie Sanders, since you're at the Kinsey Institute, do you see this as something new?
I think that this is really important. These are really important data because they do suggest, as Dr. Benick just said, that we need to really look more closely at these kinds of experiences during sexual activity and how we might intervene to avoid difficulties with pain. And I should point out this was people reporting difficulty with pain. So, it's an avenue that we really must look at in terms of, can better communication between couples help, or are there other things that we can do to help people have more pleasure and less pain.
And are we talking about younger women, middle-aged women, older women? Does it cross the board, Stephanie Sanders?
I'm going to turn that back to Debbie because she's more familiar with that data.
Go ahead, Debbie Herbert.
Yeah, it really did cross the board. And so we did see actually even slightly higher rates with the youngest women. So when they're, 18 to 29 or slightly higher than some of the older women. But I think, Stephanie made some really great points about how we can intervene, and those interventions I think would look very different in some ways for different women, right? So some older women who are experiencing vaginal dryness in connection with menopause may benefit from, for some women, the use of hormones as directed by their doctor. For others, vaginal moisturizers. For women across the lifespan, younger to older, lubricants may be helpful, different positions, and just, better communication with their partners to figure out how to have sex in ways that feels good for them rather than that feels painful or uncomfortable in a way that they don't want to feel.
Stephanie Sanders, can you talk about what has been described, I don't know if you describe it this way, but as an orgasm gap, which is that many more men think that their female partners had an orgasm than they actually have had?
I don't think that's so surprising. That we've known that that's a bit of an issue. Again, I think it suggests that there's a gap of communication between partners, and it may be useful for partners to be able to discuss whether the woman is also having an orgasm, and that we need to get past this notion that men should just kind of magically know what women need to experience that kind of pleasure, and and allow for more of a dynamic. Everybody is different, and so couples actually have to learn how to please their partners.
About a minute before our break here, but to you, Stephanie Sanders, I mean, are you saying that women are faking it, or just couples are misunderstanding or miscommunicating about this issue?
Well, I think it could be both. Sometimes women do want to lead their partner to believe they've had an orgasm when they haven't, because they don't want to hurt his feelings. And so I think, these data actually are a good way to start a dialogue among couples to help them to better communicate and to figure out how to make it pleasurable for both partners.
Well, let's take that short break. And again, we are talking with co-authors of a new study, the National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior. Stephanie Sanders is Associate Director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, where she's also a professor in the Department of Gender Studies. Debbie Herbenick is Research Scientist, Associate Director of Indiana University's Center for Sexual Health Promotion, and as I said, co-author of the study. And she's also the author of a book called Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. A sensitive subject, but an important one as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania hospitals support WHYY. As leaders in joint replacement, sports medicine, spine, and shoulder care, the physicians at 3B Orthopedics provide patients with personalized care and the latest treatment options available. More information about Booth Bartolozzi Balderston Orthopedics, the 3Bs, available by phone at 800-789-PEN. 800-789-PEN.
John DeBerry may have only just broken into his 30s, but his research on animal motion helped him invent something genius. He just won a MacArthur Genius Grant of $500,000, but animal motion?
There's lots of rejection that comes with it because it's unorthodox research.
The Nigerian-born biophysicist and what he'll do with his grant. We'll ask him next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Brat Productions supports WHYY and presents Carrie, October 2nd through November 7th. Psychological horror meets outrageous camp in this black comedy adaptation of Stephen King's legendary novel. Carrie delivers all of the thrills and horror of the original best-selling novel with surprising and hilarious new twists. Save the date for a prom night you'll never forget. For tickets, bratproductions.org or 888-283-1428.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking about a new national study on the sexual behavior of Americans from age 14 to 94. Debbie Herbenick and Stephanie Sanders are co-authors of this study. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Annie from Wayne to join our conversation. And Annie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Always enjoy your show, and
what
an interesting topic this is today. I always wonder when I hear that, you know, vast amounts of money were spent on a research study, what do we do with it? You know, what happens next? Who's going to use this information, and what are they going to do with it? And I also look forward to hearing more about the answers that younger children, had with the study as a mother of teens and emerging teens. I'm curious about that.
Well, Annie, I have to say we've got a third guest waiting in the wings to talk about young people and teenagers. But let me give Debbie Herbenick and then Stephanie Sanders a chance to respond. What happens to a study like this, Debbie?
Well, we certainly hope that a wide range of professionals make good use of it. And we know we've actually, allow for free downloads of the study from our website. And there's a brief survey that people take before they download it and asks them, you know, if they're using it for personal use or professional use and what kind of work they do. And we know that already, you know, a couple thousand school teachers have downloaded it. We know that a few thousand medical providers have downloaded it and researchers have downloaded it as well and people in public health. So we expect that a lot of people will be reading these findings carefully and trying to figure out how this fits into their, work as teachers or doctors or nurses and so on. We also, certainly hope that many parents, just like Annie, will be interested in the findings as well and will try to look at the data and see the key findings that are coming out and figure out what types of conversations these can start for them with their teenagers.
Stephanie Sanders, anything you want to add to that? And just to reinforce, you're from the Kinsey Institute, which, of course, you know, famously published research back in the, 1940s, 50s,
yes,
about sexual behavior. And there was obviously great controversy then. Do you feel like it's possible to have an adult and sort of down-to-earth conversation about sex now?
It's certainly getting to be more so the case, although, compared to some other countries, the United States still seems to have a kind of interesting relationship with sexuality. In some ways, it's all over the place, and in other ways, it's still very taboo to discuss it. So, it makes for, there still clearly are people who believe that we shouldn't do any research about sexuality. From a public health standpoint, that doesn't make much sense. From a quality of life standpoint, given that sexuality plays an important role in people's relationships, it doesn't make sense to me to not want to know about what's going on. And let me give you an example of how these data actually going to be useful in terms of the public health message. I've been doing work in condom, looking at condom use for over a decade now, and one of the, I think, good pieces of news here is that it appears that young people are getting the message that if they're going to be sexually active, they need to use condoms. And they're doing a good job at that compared to older people who may be single again. And so it suggests that we need to think about, you know, the people who may be coming single again, 50 and above, 40 and above, who may be back out dating, having sexual activity with various partners, and are not worried about pregnancy, but may need to be worried about the possibility of contracting a sexually transmitted infection.
That's fascinating, and actually a perfect segue to get Dennis Fortenberry in on the conversation. He's a professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, also a co-author of the study. He led the adolescent part of this survey. And Dennis Fortenberry, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting.
You're very welcome. And let me just ask you a couple of questions about teenagers. And as we know, we talk about teenagers a lot, about their sexual behavior. What did you find from this survey?
I think the important things that we found were that, as you would expect, sexuality becomes an increasingly important important part of young people's lives as they grow older and begin that transition into their young adulthood.
So are
as
they
a corollary? Oh, go ahead.
No. Well, just and if we're talking about teenagers, I'm assuming we're talking about what 12 to 13 year olds to 17, 18, 19 year olds.
Our data focused on 14 to 17 year olds, okay, very explicitly.
And what did you find out about the young people in terms of their actual sexual activity?
Among the younger people, say the 14 year olds, partnered sexual activity was fairly uncommon for both young men and young women. As they went through, as we went through the age groups, that proportion that it had some kind of partnered sexual activity increased. It's important to remember that in many cases, however, a large proportion of the young people at any age had not had any kind of sexual activity.
And just picking up on what Stephanie Sanders said, for those teenagers who are sexually active, are they either using condoms or using safe sex practices?
Particularly in terms of using condoms, among those that had had any kind of penile-vaginal intercourse as part of their last sexual experience, the large majority of both young men and young women at all ages reported condom use.
We have done shows, as I'm sure other programs have as well. It's certainly been in the news about things like sexting and friends with benefits. And Dennis Fortenberry, as you talk to young people, are we blowing that out of proportion?
I believe that we are. I think if you talk to a lot of young people, they will have heard the same discussions of those issues as we all have, but most of them have not actually engaged in them, and many would not even know people who have.
And are young people abstinent? Are a certain or a large proportion, or do you know the numbers of young people who are abstinent?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you define abstinent in terms of whether they've ever had sex in their entire life or whether they've had sex in the past 3 months. At any given time, for example, in the past 3 months, the majority, more than 50% of teenagers, have not had sex during that time period.
How do young people define sex?
That varies a lot. Stephanie's done a lot of research on this topic. So if you ask some young people, they would say only penile-vaginal intercourse constitutes sex. Some would even say certain forms of kissing constitute sex. In our study, we were very explicit about the sexual behaviors that we were inquiring about to give the young people as much information about our intention in the question as possible.
So how did you define sex for young people?
Well, we defined it with different behaviors. So we asked them if they had, for example, masturbated by themselves. We asked if they had masturbated with a partner. We asked them if they had given oral sex to another person, and we defined the gender of that other person as male or female. We asked if they had received oral sex from a male or female partner. We asked if they had had penile-vaginal intercourse, and we asked if they had had anal intercourse.
So a wide spectrum of behaviors. Stephanie Sanders, do you want to weigh in on this?
In previous research that we've done, we found that people vary a lot in terms of what they kind of count as having had sex, and that can be affected by the context in which it occurs as well as, you know, who you're talking to. So that's why as researchers, when we want to do this kind of work, we actually want to ask about very specific behaviors, but one of, I think, the really neat things about this study is that we also then allowed people, asked them the question, well, what did you do the last time you had sex, and allowed for them to tell us what of these behaviors were involved, and found that there were over 40 combinations of the behaviors that we asked. So, you know, how people define a sexual act depends. a lot of different behaviors may be involved.
Sure, on how they define what it is that they do. Right. Dennis Fortenberry, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. Anything you want to add or anything else that our listeners should know when it comes to teenagers and the survey and their sexual behavior?
That's all. I think this shows us a very important picture of modern adolescents who have come into their adolescence and into the early parts of their sexual lives in a new era. And I believe that we're beginning to understand that teenagers are, in fact, learning about their sexuality in some healthy ways that we could all perhaps learn a lesson from.
Well, that's a nice piece of good news there. Dennis Fortenberry, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye. Professor of Pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine and one of the authors of the study that we've been talking about led the adolescent part of the survey looking at sexual behavior in America, what teenagers are doing, what men and women are doing, what women, men are doing in midlife and into older age as well. Debbie Herbenick staying with us for the rest of the hour. Stephanie Sanders also staying with us with the hour, co-authors of this study. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Suzanne from media to join us. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to let you know I am the parent of a teenager, and one of the questions that I had was how, in the current culture that seems to be pervasive amongst the teenagers, the concept of hookup affects the quality of sex, and whether or not the survey addressed how long the person has been in a relationship with the partner with whom they recently had sex. Does it affect how much pain they feel? Have they had conversations about it? All that kind of thing. Does the survey address that? How do teenagers view that? Unfortunately, we lost the other guest, so I'm not sure that who would take that.
Well, I think I know who I'm going to start with. And Suzanne, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Stephanie Sanders, you want to begin?
Well, first of all, I want to say something about the current concept of hookup is actually that's the new terminology. These are behaviors that we've seen for generations, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century. They had different names. But the other thing is that I think we often assume that young people are having sex mostly via hookups. The reality is that most people have their sexual activity within a context of, at least some kind of relationship. And in fact, when you look at the most frequent sex, it tends to be among people who are in a relationship. So, this is a very good question, and I'd like to ask Debbie, if she would also weigh in on it.
Sure, sure. Debbie, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, Suzanne brought up some interesting issues about pain and how it fits into relationships and hooking up. And I do think, many adolescents and college students certainly define hooking up in different ways, and for some they hook up with the same person for 1 or 2 years, and it's what the rest of us would probably call a relationship, even if they call it something else. And for others, they are more fleeting experiences, but they're not necessarily detrimental to adolescent or college development. So it's common for people to explore with each other in different ways. That said, there are different types of relationships that provide different opportunities for learning about communication and negotiating what feels good or doesn't feel good emotionally or physically. We were able to ask some questions about the relationships, so we do know how long people were together, and we'll be working on another study that looks at the pain issue in much more detail. So we haven't looked at this point about the duration of the relationship and how that relates to perceptions of pain. We unfortunately did not ask about conversations about the pain issue, so we don't have that data, but I certainly hope that whether it's our team or other teams out there, that this issue of pain and how people feel about it and how it works in their relationships and what type of help they seek, whether it's from parents or friends or healthcare providers and talking about it, I certainly hope that more people investigate it because it's important.
Sure. Well, and what I hear you saying, just to underscore what you both just said, which is that, today it's called hooking up, but back in the 60s it was free love. And I hear, Stephanie Sanders, from your perspective, which is this is what young people do. They explore their sexuality.
Yes.
And we just call it different things.
Yes.
And wring our hands over it, too, as
yes.
well.
And I think that Demi makes another really good point about how that phrase, again, is not really specific. You know, how people use the phrase hooking up varies.
Let me put something else out there, and I don't think Christine O'Donnell, the Republican candidate for Senate in Delaware, meant to do this, but certainly masturbation has been in the news, and this survey looks at that. And I wonder, Debbie Herbenick, if you could just talk about what's happening here.
We certainly found that masturbation is common among both women and men. It's certainly more common among men and more frequent among men, and this echoes plenty of other research that has found it as well. We were able, of course, to ask teenagers the same kinds of questions that we asked adults with the permission of their parents who consented to let them to participate in our study. And we found teenagers, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, engaging in masturbation as well. For adolescent men, this actually increased with each age, and for adolescent women, it was curiously kind of stable with the percentages that engage in it. So there's some interesting stuff going on. I think one of the biggest take-home messages, especially about male masturbation, though, is how common it really is. And this is whether men are single or partnered or married. This is true for women, too, that it's common in different relationship structures. Unfortunately, as somebody who also works as a sex educator and columnist, I do hear from many men who feel stigmatized for their masturbation, and many women who are in relationships with men, who worry that their boyfriends or husbands shouldn't be masturbating anymore, and they wonder why they are, and they wonder if it means something bad about them. But I think what we see is this is just a very common feature of human sexuality, and it doesn't mean that somebody isn't a good partner or isn't attractive or somebody's not in love with them anymore. That this hopefully will shed additional light to help people feel less stigma about a very natural, common, and healthy part of human sexual behavior.
And Stephanie Sanders, even going back to the research, looking at masturbation, that you found that obviously people doing it alone, but also the partners are doing this as well. Can you explain that?
The question there could probably involve a variety of behaviors in terms of stimulating oneself and stimulating the partner manually. So, but the point there is that, you know, that it is a manual stimulation with partners together. And that is a common behavior as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, clearly an adult conversation here on Radio Times, but frankly one that we think is important, helping us understand the sexual lives of American men, women, and teenagers. Researchers at Indiana University released a study, a very comprehensive national survey of American sexual behavior, and we are talking with two of the co-authors. Debbie Herbenick, research scientist, associate director of Indiana University Center for Sexual Health Promotion, and she wrote a book called Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Stephanie Sanders, associate director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, where she's also a professor in the Department of Gender Studies. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And this study raises a whole host of important questions related to one's sexuality and public health and relationships as well. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Inflammatory breast cancer is a rare form of breast cancer which is unlikely to show up on mammograms. Symptoms, which can include swelling or skin irritation, can often be mistaken for mastitis. Early diagnosis can save lives. Fox Chase's Inflammatory Breast Cancer Clinic provides specialized diagnostics and treatment for this rapidly moving cancer. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
On the next Fresh Air, Justin Timberlake. He's co-starring in the new film, The Social Network. We'll talk with him about his acting and his music.
I don't know where that line came from. I sometimes regret it because I feel like people feel like it's an extension of who I am.
Justin Timberlake on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. In Wisconsin, Senator Russ Feingold is in a tight race to hold on to his seat. We'll check in Wisconsin and Florida. Also, an American woman adopts a child in Nepal only to find that because of new U.S. policy, she can't bring her home. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. And we have Rich from Wilmington. Hi, Rich. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I've been listening to the conversation, and it's been detailed in lots of ways, except this one. And I'm wondering about what is the, The awareness of the endocrine system and how broad its effect is on the human body and its well-being is something that I've only recently begun to look into and am astonished at everything that goes on. What is sexual well-being in relation to the function of the endocrine system, and is this being studied? Are you guys aware of the fallout of, faulty endocrine function and lack of sexual well-being? I'll go off the air now.
Okay, Rich. I appreciate the call to Radio Times and clearly some emotion associated with that question. Stephanie, I'm going to start with you. I don't know. Can you answer Rich's question?
Yeah, I'd like to. Actually, this study was not designed to get at that kind of information. Mm-hmm. There is an increasing amount of research about looking at the endocrine system, not only in terms of sex hormones and their relationship to sexual functioning, but also other endocrine disorders and how they can affect sexual functioning. And it's really important for individuals who may be experiencing various kinds of endocrine or hormonal disruptions in various ways to be able to find a healthcare provider that they can discuss the situation with, because often things can be done to help such individuals. The other thing is that increasingly we're becoming aware of how various types of medications can interact with sexual functioning. And again, it means that it's very important to be able to have an open dialogue with a healthcare provider and to just be frank and to feel entitled to your sexual functioning and sexual well-being as part of overall health.
Rich, you asked a very important question. Debbie, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
I think Stephanie made some very good points about that. I'll leave it there.
Fair enough. Let me get Mark from Yardley to join us on Radio Times. And Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering about the research study and whether it addressed the interplay between substance use and abuse and sexual experiences across the developmental lifespan.
And Mark, I'm just curious what your interest is in that question.
Sure. I work with individuals experiencing substance abuse problems, and they often talk about their experiences while they were using versus being in recovery and how that experience changes.
Debbie Herbenick, do you want to take that?
We did ask about limited numbers of questions about alcohol use and marijuana use. We haven't really looked at it so much in terms of a little bit in terms of quality, but not as much. But Stephanie can actually speak to some of the issues related to substance use, particularly related to condom use and safer sex.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Well, so let me first say that, you know, in this kind of a sample, we're not looking at people in general who have, you know, high chronic use of these materials or have, you know, for the most part been labeled as abusers. So we did have a question about whether alcohol and drugs were used in relation to during this, you know, near the time of the sexual act, and whether or not condoms were used, and found that actually there was not a very strong relationship in the general population between these use. And we asked about the person's own use, their partner's use, and whether they both used.
Hmm.
So I would say that, now on the other hand, not drawing from this study, but knowing that chronic use of alcohol or various kinds of drug substances can also interact with the endocrine system as well as affecting judgment. So in those two ways, it can affect sexuality and sexual behaviors of people who are engaged in high use of those drugs.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ann from Fayetteville, Arkansas, to join us. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wondered whether this study addressed female ejaculation, and if so, what percentage of women they found who reported experiencing that. I'll take my answer off the air.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Can I go with you first, Stephanie Sanders? I'm a little bit in the dark here, but go ahead.
Okay. This was not a main part of the finding, but I think Dr. Hrbenek, Debbie, could add something to this discussion.
And I guess in part because you're the author of a book called "Because It Feels Good."
Right.
Go ahead, Debbie Hrbenek.
You know, unfortunately, we didn't ask about it, and there were so many things we wanted to ask about and had to cut or not include because we had limited space and time and funding. However, female ejaculation is a very interesting topic. It remains controversial, even among people who study sex. It does seem to be clear that there's a proportion of women who, release some fluids when they experience sexual excitement or orgasm, some more than others, more fluids than others. But we really don't know what that percentage is. There have been convenience studies of women, and some studies will end up with 10% or 15%, and some will wind up saying 40%. So unfortunately, we just don't know. We do know that this is not all in women's heads, that they are not peeing during sex, which many of them worry that they are, although if a woman has incontinence issues during her daily activities, she might want to check in with a doctor to make sure. But for women who just experience this wetness during sex, it tends not to be any type of incontinence issue. One of the great books I actually think that provides a lot of information about this is the original book, The G-Spot, although there's an updated version now, because it provides so many quotes from women about their experiences and, women and their partners who love it, women and their partners who try to, minimize things by using towels and so on. But this full range of experience and descriptions of women who have wondered, why does no one talk about this? So it's something we don't know enough about, but it is a very real experience for many women and their partners.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Debbie, if I can go back to you, did you in any way ask people, or have you even in your research talked with couples or women about the use of sex toys? Is that more common these days, do you think?
That's a great question. We actually did another nationally representative study a couple of years ago that was focused on sexual enhancement and pleasure and the use of sexual enhancement products such as vibrators. And we did find that 53% of women and nearly half of men had ever used a vibrator. Women's use was most of them had used a vibrator both alone and with a partner. Most of men's use was with a female partner, but not all of it. And nearly one out of five men had described using a vibrator while they were by themselves during masturbation. So it's very common. It's very common these days for people to incorporate sex toys into their masturbation or their sex with a partner.
Stephanie, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that this is something we're increasingly seeing, even with that there are a number of there's products out there that are being designed to help enhance the sexual experience. And this is becoming, more integrated into people's sex lives.
Let me ask you, and I'll start with you, Stephanie Sanders, about same-sex encounters, because that's something else that this survey looked at. And what did you find?
Well, we found that, something that has been documented elsewhere, that not all people who have engaged in same-sex sexual interactions label themselves as gay or bisexual. So in other words, behavioral bisexuality or having had a same-sex experience is more common than labeling oneself as gay or bisexual or lesbian. There are also some other words that people use, but we allowed for that.
Right.
And so I think what we're seeing here, though, is that people use that label to describe themselves at the time of the survey. We also need to keep in mind this survey wasn't really focused so much on that we don't know what they might have previously called themselves. It's like, what are you calling yourself at the time of the survey?
But does it tell you that people are sort of exploring their sexuality in broader ways?
I don't know. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of equivalent data from the past, but we do know that having same-sex sexual experiences is not new to the 21st century or even the late 20th century. And whether people may be more willing to disclose that or even willing to entertain it as you know, as a possibility mm-hmm. in their lives may be changing. Certainly the dialogue around same-sex interactions has changed in the last 50 years. And so I'd say that it could be part of, you know, exploring oneself. The other thing, though, is that people may not see the labeling of themselves as bisexual or gay as stigmatized as in previous generations. So I think that the kind of the important message here is that people should understand that the self-labeling is one aspect of a person's sexuality. Their behavioral patterns may be another, and that the behavioral patterns are not necessarily predictive of how a person will conceive their sexual identity.
And Debbie, again, anything you want to add to that? I think that this survey found that 7 to 8% of men and women identified themselves as either gay, lesbian, and or bisexual.
It did, and I think actually Stephanie did a great job summarizing that.
Well, then let me ask you about older Americans, because you did include in the survey people as old as 94, and are people remaining more sexually active into their older age, would you say? Or is there any way to know the answer to that question?
Yeah, more is probably not a thing we can address really well. Of course, when Kinsey was doing his research in the 1930s, 40s, and early 50s, people didn't live as long. And as a result, many of the people in his survey, most of them, were under the age of 50. When the last nationally representative study, big one, was done 20 years ago, it didn't include anyone over the age of 60. A few years ago, there was a great nationally representative study done on people who are 57 and up. But, you know, that was just a few years ago. And so, you know, has anything really changed in the last 4 years? You know, probably not in that study, and the study wasn't set up to do a direct comparison. What we do know is that there certainly is a proportion of people, men and women, who remain sexually active, whether that is alone during masturbation or during sex with a partner. These are not massive amounts of people. It's not the majority of people, particularly once you get into the 70s and 80s. Men also tend to more men tend to be sexually active with a partner than women. In part, this is likely because many women who are interested in men don't have as many options available to them. There's, you know, greater likelihood for men to develop serious illness or to die in older age, and so you have more men, of course, alive than women. And so even this, the possibility of a partner or a relationship partner becomes a very different landscape with older age. So we found really different numbers for men in their 70s and 80s, for example, who are engaging in vaginal intercourse or oral sex compared to women. I think one of the more interesting things along these lines that's important is that sometimes when data comes out about older people and sexuality, you know, people can find this very liberating because it can mean that as you age, sex doesn't have to end. But I also think we always, you know, we should temper that so that we don't create a new expectation for sex as people age. Sometimes, you know, there are news reports about somebody running their first marathon at age 70, but of course that doesn't mean we should all be running marathons when we get in our 70s. Some people are happy to put their running days behind them, or, you know, happy to change the way they live their lives in different ways. It doesn't mean that everyone wants to keep having sex or wants to keep having sex the way that they did or as often as they did when they were younger. So one of the most important findings I think we found from the study is that people are very diverse in the way that they live their sexual lives, whether that means having sex with same or other sex partners, whether that means engaging in one of these 41 combinations of sex, or engaging in different types of behaviors. And I just think with age, we need to realize that there are many possibilities.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but I want to give you a chance, Stephanie Sanders, just to weigh in on that. And what I hear from both of you, and frankly read in this survey, is that, you know, there are just so many permutations and so many ways that people can feel pleasure.
Absolutely, and I think that that is the important message, is that people, you know, do live their lives in, you know, their sexual lives in different ways, and probably at different ways at different points in their life. The other thing is that it's important to periodically have studies like this, because we can look at age, the current age of people. We have to keep in mind that, you know, the people who are 40 and 50 now are going to be 60 and 70 in 20 years. And they've had different life experiences that they're going to bring into old age as well, including, you know, perhaps better access to better health care.
And do you think, Stephanie, that we are more literate as a culture when it comes to sex and sexuality?
More than whom?
Well, more than we used to be. I don't know.
Perhaps. And I think that is really the important aspect of really having people understand that sexual health is part of overall health, and that it's important to learn about it and learn how to live a healthy sexual life.
Well, that seems like a good place to end our conversation. Stephanie Sanders, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Debbie Herbenick, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And they are co-authors of this new study, which was published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine. And it was a survey of people's sexual behaviors in this country, ages 14 to 94. And Debbie Herbenick is Associate Director of the Indiana University Center for Sexual Health Promotion. And Stephanie Sanders, Associate Director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. Go to whyy.org/radio. Times, and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowain, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, which is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Thank you so much for joining us, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.